This is Darth Obi-Wan. What is this I hear about Saga Edition being dead? Bullshit. It's not dead till we say it's dead. Oh, and never listen to the Order 66 podcast. Count Dooku did, and, well, you saw what happened to him. Peace, guys.
Hello, meatbags. My name is HK13, and I never listen to the Order 66 podcast because Star Wars Saga Edition is dead. Long live Star Wars Saga Edition.
This is Animus, and I never listen to the Order 66 podcast because... Great show, guys. Here's the 2010, and go Saints!
D20 Radio, where gamers roll. www.d20radio.com.
Execute Order 66.
This episode of the Order 66 podcast brought to you in part by our sponsors GoDaddy.com and Audible.com. Download a free audiobook today. Also by D20 Radio contributors Robert Dorgan, Sendragon on the forums, Jesse Butts, Joe Butts on the forums, and Mark Waters, Sparky22. This episode is for you guys. Welcome back, guys, girls, Gamer Nation, episode number 95 of the Order 66 podcast for Sunday, January 31st, 2010. Not 2010, I might add, because that's driving me up the friggin' wall, but that's neither here nor there. I'm GM Dave, one of your hosts this evening, and that giggle you heard, she's back. Pregalotta is feeling better.
Prega something.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you, Dave, for the intro. And why not 2010?
Oh, 2010 is fine, too, but the people who are saying 2010. I mean, did we say 19 and 99? No.
Although it'd be funny if we did. Just saying.
Twood.
Yeah. Oh, there's somebody else here, too.
Oh, hey, yeah, it's GM Chris.
What is up, Gamer Nation? Well, for those of you who are tuning into this tongue tangled mystery of the macabre for the first time, this is the Order 66 podcast, the only podcast entirely devoted to the Star Wars Saga Edition role playing game, and we welcome you. It's been an interesting week.
Yeah, a little bit.
But we'll get to some of that coming up. But no, we got a great show for you guys planned tonight, so I'm excited.
So am I, as a matter of fact. So let's just get to it.
Accessing.
Ah, good. New acquisitions.
Greetings, Gamer Nation. My designation is KCK Sim, and this is your HoloNewsNet update.
Ah, yes.
Uh-huh.
And then some.
And then, yeah, exactly.
Stop. Stop.
What?
And then.
Stop.
And then.
Are you saying all stop?
Yeah, it's the notes say stop, so I just figured I'd tell y'all to stop.
No,
I don't know what that means.
No, 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 no. It means that our featured podcast this week is All Stop. That's what it means. It is one of the two newest. How many say, how do you say fewer viewers? Do you say fewer viewers or less viewers? Fewer viewers, because that's what we just got. Hello, chat room, by the way. 51 of you in the chat room. Thank you for joining us this early Sunday instead of watching the Emmys. Or the, what are they? Are the Emmys Award? What's going on tonight?
Emmys.
Or the Grammys?
Yes, Grammys, that's right.
It's the Grammys, so okay. Yeah.
The one with the giant gramophone on it, hence the Grammys.
The Grammys, yes. Okay, so back to, one of the newest additions to our network, All Stop, is a podcast devoted to the newest MMO currently out on the market, getting ready to launch on Tuesday, Star Trek Online. So episode number one is up, available for download. Phil and Gonzo, as the Admiral and Commodore of the 66th Fleet, discuss the open beta, you know, ins, outs, bridge officers, helpful tips and hints for new players getting up and getting through the first few levels of play. And I, for one, on behalf of my two co-hosts, am proud to welcome them to the lineup, boldly going where no podcast has gone before, at least not on our network.
No.
I will always support anything that's Star Trek related.
Word.
Yep.
Word.
Yep. Yep.
Maybe blasphemy to say on a Star Wars podcast, but I'm throwing it out there.
You know what? I'm a fan of franchise, you know, mingling. You know, I'm very liberal that way, so it's okay.
Yeah, I'm fine with that. Yeah.
Well, for Pete's sake, TG, I mean, this new podcast is all fine and dandy, but we've got 17 plus podcasts on the network now.
Yeah.
Heaven's sake, if people want to find out more, where on earth might they go?
Well, they could come to our house, which is in Plano, Texas, at...
No.
There we go.
No. No. No,
that would be bad.
Put that out on the intertube.
Oh, crap.
Al Gore will be at your house.
They could email you, right?
They could, but there's an even easier way.
Oh. The website?
Yes!
Yes, I got it. Would that be d20radio.com?
Would be. You always seem to have trouble with that question. You think after so many weeks you'd finally remember, but I don't know.
Hey, it's the baby's fault. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. Get tired of that excuse. Well, Dave, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that you have an open call for the Gamer Nation's help. Do you not?
I haven't actually. We discussed this Thursday, Friday at the office, and I don't think I've put anything on the forum yet, but this will serve as notice. Last year, for the 50th or 52nd episode, I forget which, 50th, I think.
Yes, 50th.
I did about a 9-minute mashup of lots of funny bits and little things that we said, you know, through the first year of our existence. We did not do a second year show because, well, hell, it's the second year. I mean, seriously, there's nothing special about it besides it being number two. And I don't mean doo-doo. What?
I'm glad you said that because that's where my mind went.
Of course. Yeah, you have to.
Of course.
You have to because you never know when all of a sudden fart comes right out. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't have time to do it this year, but this episode number 100 is going to serve as the 2-year extravaganza, kind of a reconnoiter of where the podcast is, and we've got some announcements as to how the podcast will be structured in the future, especially given the news that has just come out that we'll get to a little bit later, and have a restructuring in the host and all that good stuff that we've alluded to, but we said we'd announce it on episode 100. Well, I'd like to do another montage for another year of podcasting, so if you guys know of any little bits, give me a timestamp. And I mean down to the second. I'll say, oh, somewhere around the 34th minute. Well, that doesn't help. Minute and second as to where it is in the podcast, and I'll go and pull it. And if it's funny, I'll put it in a little mashup thing, and that'd be awesome. If you're even more industrious, you could pull it off, use Audacity to record it or something, and send me the snippet. That would even be better. But you don't have to. Just point me to it, and I'll grab it and make a little montage for year number two.
That's what she said. Point me to it. I'll grab it.
We'll so if any of you are catching up on episodes 51 through 99, and you do come across something humorous for a mashup,
Yep.
Let the Dave know.
Absolutely.
It's a goodness.
Yep.
Well, dude, I'm excited because for the first time in a while, we have some juicy bits of web goodness.
And it'll be the last.
Oh, I doubt it. But... new Saga content is up on the Wizards website. The brilliant 25 to Rescue mini scenario by D20 Radio's own Sterling Hershey, who I see is in Echo Base chat right now. Hello, Sterling. Has actually been turned into a full-fledged Saga encounter by the noted author. Help rescue and save the lives of 25 civilians during the Clone Wars in a vicious battle on the planet Christophsis. And you can find this cool scenario right now at www.wizards.com/Star Wars.
Yep.
Wow.
Awesome. In keeping with the last couple of shows, you guys check out Syndicon. It is coming up in 1.5 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Or two
D.C.
weeks. 2 weeks, I guess. Washington, D.C. Alpha Ant will be there running a few sessions of Saga. And find out more at syndicon.net. That's syndicon.net. Also in Minnesota. Yeah, Minnesota. You know, they're funny looking in a general kind of way up there. ScorchCon 2010. Minnesota State University at Moorhead, March 6th and 7th, so you've got about a month there. Cyril will be up there throwing down some Saga Edition, and you can find out more at ScorchCon, S-C-O-R-S. I'm going to quit.
S-C-O-R.
C-H.
C-H-C-O-N.com.
Yeah.
See, was that hard?
Okay.
It actually was kind of hard, Dave.
HOTWIRE, hotwire.com. Woo!
Oh, man. And then, of course, Gen Con coming up in August. And remember, guys, we announced this last week. You want to get to Gen Con this year to participate in the Gygax Memorial Auction, where you can have a chance to own some personal belongings of Gary Gygax and contribute to the memorial fund that is being built, the memorial that is being built to him in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin.
Ah. So IRL Potato says he already has a episode title for this episode, even though we're 11 minutes in. So
that's impressive.
Yeah, that is something else. All right, so hey, man, contest, dude.
Dude, contest. Tell us, contest. You're the one with the maps slavering on your desk.
That's
full
right.
Of...
So yeah, we've talked about this last couple shows. You guys have until March 17th to get us an encounter built around map maker Chris West's fine work. The Swamp Caves map or the Desert Sanctum on the back. Find out more at mapsofmastery.com as to seeing the map. The idea there is build an encounter, any level, for a standard 5-member party. And the details and submission guidelines are at d20radio.com/forum. And you will be able to get up to speed and send in your work, your fine work. It might even get published on our site for
quite
everyone
possible
to see. Yeah, it probably will be, but it'll be judged by the likes of Sam Witwer and GM Chris and Chris West, not to mention the venerable Chuck Hurstius. So,
oh my God, Chuck Hurstius! Oh my God, oh my God, oh yeah, my God, course. Oh my God, oh my God. And TG as well, which got to throw props, you know. To TG.
Of course you gotta throw props to TG.
Yeah.
Because are you well propified, TG?
I'm feeling pretty propped right now.
Awesome.
Just call me PP. Never mind, don't call me that. Pretty propped. Never mind.
All right. So
moving on.
I think we've got a little bit of what would you call it here? I think we've got one other piece of news, and then, yeah.
Well, it's a piece of news, and most of you probably already know this. So, okay, Gamer Nation, if you have not heard, Wizards of the Coast has officially announced the end of the Star Wars line. To paraphrase Greg Yon, WotC Director of Marketing, there have been several questions lately regarding the future of Star Wars miniatures and role-playing game, and until now, I haven't had definitive answers to give you. After a lengthy evaluation, Wizards of the Coast has decided...
Bring out your dead.
Yeah, no problem.
But I'm not dead yet.
They're not dead yet. Wizards of the Coast has decided not to renew the Star Wars license with Lucasfilm. We've had a long and fantastic run, but with the economic downturn, we've made the tough decision to discontinue the Star Wars line. The license officially ends in May this year, with WotC products available through August. In the meantime, we have awesome new products still coming your way. WotC will, of course, guys, still be releasing Unknown Regions in April, as well as the final set of Star Wars minis, Masters of the Force. Okay, Gamer Nation. For many people, this announcement, though disappointing, wasn't exactly too surprising. After August, all official Star Wars support through WotC will be at an end. Now, the fan response to this announcement has been all over the board, but the majority of this response has been of like mind, and I want to take the opportunity right now to wholeheartedly agree, and that response is thank you. Thank you, Wizards of the Coast, Rodney Thompson, and every hardworking freelancer who's poured themselves into this amazing, amazing system. You know, I think it's sad that to know that no more official material is going to come out, but what we have is so incredible, and it gives us enough to continue playing this amazing game forever. In my opinion, with Unknown Regions coming out, this is going to be a concluded system with 13 titles, a GM screen, scores of maps and tiles, and a full 20-level official adventure path. There are many role-playing games, guys, that could be asking that could ask for more than that. This news shocked a lot of people, and within hours, the dozens of emails that Dave and myself received at the Order 66 podcast were also rather overwhelming. Many of you had questions about how this is going to affect the podcast, and we do have an answer for that.
We're done. We're done. That's it. Episode 100 is over. Show's over.
Totally, completely. Done. Psych! Yeah.
It's not even April 1st.
It's not even April 1st. How does the answer not a damn bit work for you? That's how much it's going to affect this podcast. This podcast is not going anywhere, Gamer Nation. We have enough Saga goodness to talk about for years and years to come. And with the amazing player base this game has, a strong community, and the fans, it will continue to be played in perpetuity. The bottom line is, we will not stop pimping it until you stop playing it. And it doesn't look like that's going to happen anytime soon. But we do want to take a moment to stop and thank Wizards, Rodney, Sterling, Gary, Patrick, John, every other developer that we've spoken with and gotten the chance to know who's poured their hearts into what I firmly believe is the greatest RPG that I have ever played. So thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
You know, this is like, it's weird, man. It's like, this is like sad news kind of, but I'm actually a tad relieved a little bit. I was talking to some friends about it and like Brev and this sounds strange, but the last thing I really ever wanted for was this system to become just a bloated husk of a system with conflicting and redundant rules and just duffel bags full of books, which will always happen if you continue to make books.
3-5.
Yeah. So, you know, in some ways, I think this was a good thing. Perhaps one of the best things to happen.
See, why? You know what? The new podcast that we've got started for D&D 3-5.
Yeah, that's right.
Those guys have unlimited, literally. Unlimited shows that they can do.
Unlimited shows, yes. Seriously. 3 duffel bags of books I have. 3 duffel bags of just 3-5. So, you know, I'm glad the system didn't get to that point. But ultimately, this is a good thing to happen because this opens up the door now for an unprecedented amount of fan-generated and fan-run games, supplements, and add-ons because, well, frankly, there's really no alternative at this point. So the bottom line is, Gamer Nation, it is our time, baby, Goonies style. It's our time to keep this game going strong. And each and every one of you can consider this now officially an open call. The D20 Radio Network will be revamping its download page, and we will be proud to serve as an active free hoster for quality modules and supplements that you create for this amazing system. Things created by us, the fans, and the gamers. So there we go. This game is, and always has been, folks, what we make it. Gamer Nation. And now more than ever, this is a glorious time, my friends, and it's a glorious opportunity. When I first got the news of this announcement, the guy who emailed it to me, the subject heading for the email was simply, Saga is dead. And after reviewing the announcement, I emailed him back and I said, Saga is dead. Long live Saga Edition! And that's pretty much my opinion on it. So there we go. Thank you, Watsy, for all you've given us, but this cast is going to remain strong. And I know our community will as well.
Yep. And with that.
Amen.
Amen, brother man. With that.
This is a Holonet News update. I'm Luke Lowbrow. Tonight's update is brought to you by Wilro Hood's Best Ice Cream on Bespin. Wilro protected his family's secret ice cream maker from falling into the hands of an invading Imperial garrison force. When it was time to evacuate Cloud City, Wilro knew what to save. His ice cream maker. That's right, you heard me correctly. He didn't grab jewelry, keepsakes, or even attempt to evacuate his wife and children. Nope. All that stuff can be replaced. But the Hood family ice cream maker that had been passed down from generation to generation, it needed to be protected. so you and your loved ones can enjoy Will Rowe Hood's best ice cream on Bespin. Now for the news. The Black Sun Criminal Syndicate voted to abandon the term Vigo to describe its high-ranking operatives because they decided Vigo just sounds too silly to depict a fearsome and dangerous underworld criminal. Vigo sounds like a hair gel product, or a guy from Jersey who buys a lot of hair gel products. The Black Sun has narrowed the replacement title down to three top contenders. First, the Black Sun Itchy Chode. Second, the Black Sun Oozing Cactus Muffin Pustule. Or the third option, the Black Sun Big Old Nanny Nanny Boo Boo Head. In other news, the Anti-Gungan Defamation League has filed suit against the BICO Landspeeder Insurance Company for their ad campaign that states, quote, "It would be so stupid not to get BICO insurance, only a Gungan wouldn't do it." And one of their radio ads that states, "Not getting BICO insurance means you're incapable of the basic management of your personal finances and you should be a ward of the state, or you're a Gungan." The Anti-Gungan Defamation League is not expected to win this court battle. Tonight's update was also brought to you by BICO, AT-AT, and AT-ST Walker Insurance. We know it's not your fault those pesky Ewoks destroyed your AT-ST with a couple of logs and a bow and arrow. You know you don't want the Empire to garner your wages to pay for that thing. BICO Insurance offers Ewok accident forgiveness. It's hard enough guarding a secret Imperial shield station without the anxiety of what those little jerks can do to your equipment. BICO Walker Insurance. It's time to stick it to the little guy. This is Good Night from Luke Lowbrow and all of us on the Holonet News Network team.
Very nice.
That's pretty good.
It's time to stick it to the little guy.
Oh, yes.
So, okay, jerkwads. Yeah, by the way, I did get my hearing in court last week, and I'm pleased to say that my troubles with the Empire have ended. You can continue to broadcast these stupid little postcards. That's fine. I've reached an amicable agreement with the ISB, which I really can't discuss the details of at this time. But I would like to thank my team of Wookiee lawyers for really helping me out. I think that was kind of the clincher for putting it over the edge. So, yeah, go ahead, play it. I no doubt you got one. Yeah, I sure don't. So, yeah.
No, no, of course doubt. You wouldn't, because you're a jerk like that. But
he's a jerk. Jerk.
Uh huh.
I didn't get one either. I think he's sending them to you now.
Yeah, he's sending them to me now. Yeah. So I got some other things from him, but I'll just read you the postcard. And the picture on this postcard is of a dry, deserted, or it's not deserted, but desert covered world. So it's got lots of ice cream and chocolate. No, just kidding. Desert, like sand. The wording on the postcard reads, "Let your love of history take hold in the fabulous museums of Triffus."
From across the galaxy, it's time for Postcards from Commander Cody.
TG, my unit spent nearly 3 days on Umgul after losing so many men and weeks of being on the run. I can't say we didn't enjoy the R&R. Though we stayed mostly to ourselves, we quickly contacted the Rebellion and arranged a pickup and rendezvous. This left us with a few days to rest, and I even got to take in an Umgulian blob race. Strange sight. Eventually, we left on a Rebel sympathizer's cargo transport to be ferried off to the world of Triffus. The Triffus system is in the mid-rib, and Triffus itself is a small world, home to an old race of aliens called the Triffians, a fat and hairy people with blue-skinned faces and throat pouches. They have flat feet and massive thermoregulator flaps on the sides of their heads let them easily deal with the shifting desert sands and blistering heat of this world. I've only ever encountered one other Triffian before, a famous pod racer I met on Malastare many years ago. The Triffians are a strange lot. Despite their bleak surroundings, they have a love of culture and ancient history. You wouldn't know it now to look at the almost primitive race, but their past must have been grand. Triffian ruins litter the planet, hinting of an ancient, grand culture with cities and industry. The natives have a love of this forgotten past and have built dozens of huge museums to display and ponder their ancient statues, architecture, and culture. Though travel here is rare, archaeological scholars come here frequently, You know, I think the somewhat standard travel routes, mixed with the sparse population, have led the rebellion to set up a base. We've been brought here for a planning session. Something big is happening, but I'm not sure what. Not yet. Our recent efforts in sabotage have coincided with rebel spies' efforts to halt some type of secret imperial project. Whatever our intelligence networks finally uncovered, it spurred us to action. Now hundreds of rebel agents have gathered here for further debriefing and mission planning. I can only hope to contribute, play my part well. We're gathering shortly, so I'll best be off. Whatever's going on, it's big. Wish us luck. If you guys are in the mid-rim, and you want to brush up on your archaeology skills, head to Trivis. Later, guys. Long live the Rebellion. Your secret correspondent, Commander Code.
Dave?
Trivis.
I'm a little worried that he's sending us such detailed information. I mean, we've got GM Chris over here. I'm sure he's reporting every last single little detail
and,
back.
And, you know, one thing I've
always
said.
I wish we could get in touch with him to let him know that he doesn't need to be so detailed.
Well, hopefully he'll hear this, but I mean, even back when he was an Imperial correspondent to us, I never accused him of being smart.
Aw, Dave.
So, you know, I'm glad he's
turned. He's got a good heart.
That,
yeah, I mean, come on.
All right.
All right.
Yeah, good hearts. Where do they get you exactly? Yeah.
D20 docking bay, hosers. When it don't be making sense, we be making sense of it.
Well, beautiful. D20 docking bay. Listener questions coming in. Email GM Dave or GM Chris at d20radio.com or tweet at goodness at d20radio.com or via the Lusa line, which is
206-600-5872 LUSA. Lusa.
Beautiful.
Lusa.
Or on the forums, which is where this one came from Ganthet.
Hit us. TG, hit us.
Ganthet.
Ganthet had an equipment question, and it says, this is coming up in a game where I am in, and the GM and I have been trying to figure this out. Most armor in Star Wars has helmets, even the flak vest, which is the pretty much most basic armor. Do all these helmets have the basic helmet package that is mentioned in the player's handbook, or do you have to pay for this as well? I also need to know if the comm system they use for the flight suits is in the helmet or part of the fighter that they are fighting in or flying in.
Well, this is a pretty simple answer. Dave, do you know the answer to this question?
Yeah, I do, actually. And I'm going to say no. So Shadowstar has a question that he has.
We should probably elucidate just a bit.
Oh, okay.
Just a little bit.
Okay. Not all helmets will have a helmet package. Okay. Shadowstar has a question.
I think we should elucidate probably a little bit more.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Ganthet, the description of each set of armor details any add-ons that it comes with. Okay. The most notable and readily available example of this is the Stormtrooper armor, page 133 of the Core Rulebook, which is called out as having both a helmet package and an integrated comlink. If the armor doesn't list any of those things in the description, it is not part of the standard armor. But considering helmet packages cost 0 upgrade points and they are extremely inexpensive, it's not hard to upgrade. And as a GM, I think you're also well within your bounds if you want to just add these items to any NPCs you create or use who happen to have helmets. As for the flight suit comlink issue, I would have to say the comlink is part of the ship. The flight suit doesn't call one out as a built-in in the traits for its descriptions. So, there you go.
Cool. Shadowstar has a question.
Oh, okay. Great.
Yeah. He says, the SECR states that an adjacent...
That's Saga Edition Core Rulebook.
Okay.
He used an acronym.
The Edition Core Rulebook. Yeah,
Saga
but
Edition,
you could just put Player Handbook,
how about,
PhD,
how about,
right?
Or CRB.
Or CRP, core rulebook, yeah.
Core rulebook, yeah. You know? I mean, when I see SECR, I'm scrambling. I'm like, what the hell?
SECR, yeah. I mean, exactly.
Southeast Credit Report, I don't know what that is. All right, Shadow Star, you are banned from sending in questions until you get your acronyms correct. We have a naming convention around here, pal.
Really?
Right. That's right. You can't just go make up your own acronyms because then it won't fit or won't be appropriate.
You know, I'm sorry. Shadow Star has been on the boards longer than TG has, for Pete's sake. I think he was one of the OGs. He was one of our first moderators.
I think
he has earned the right to have proprietary naming convention capability.
Okay, fine. Whatever. Did he have a question? I forgot. Did he actually have a question?
Yeah.
He has a
real question.
Okay. All right, cool.
Yeah. So in the core rulebook, it states that an adjacent enemy never has cover. Then cover rules for big creatures state that such creatures determine cover against melee attacks slightly differently than smaller creatures. It says that such a creature can choose any square that it occupies to determine whether an opponent has cover against its melee attacks. Similarly, when making a melee attack against such a creature, you can pick any of the squares it occupies to determine whether it has cover against you. To me, this is Shadow Star, not me, it seems like the adjacent creatures, regardless of the big creatures and cover rules, would not have cover relative to each other because they could simply choose to attack the creature using an adjacent square. This seems especially so because cover isn't determined by the defender the way these rules are written. Do the big creatures and cover rules therefore pretty much only effectively apply to attacks with reach?
That's a good question, but a confusing one.
A long one.
Yes. But it's a confusing issue, and I see where he's coming from. The rules are a bit confusing. Now, to kind of summarize, page 157 of the core rulebook covers these issues, Shadow Star, and you are correct in that adjacent creatures never have cover from one another. So, Dave, if I am standing on one side of a low wall and you're standing on the other side and we're whacking away at each other, we don't have cover from each other. Okay, it doesn't make sense.
Right.
Okay. The seeming confusion comes from the next section on big creatures and cover, where, again, in summary, a creature that occupies multiple squares can choose the best of its squares to determine your cover to it. So picture a Rancor, okay, which occupies multiple squares and has a two-square reach, okay? Now, though uncommon, it is possible for a character to have cover from one of the Rancor's squares but not another in melee, okay? Because it's so big, all right? This rule simply clarifies that the Rancor can choose which of its squares it attacks from for the purposes of negating cover rules. So if, because we're adjacent and the Rancor is on one side of a low wall and I'm on this side of the low wall, you're correct. The attacker does determine the cover. The defender can't say, well, that one square on his hind leg is two squares away from me, therefore he's not adjacent to me, therefore I get cover. That's not what it's saying. That's saying it doesn't work that way.
Nah.
Okay?
Thank you for playing.
So there you go. So the no cover between adjacent foes, you know, honestly, this rarely comes into play. But as you do know, with creatures with reach, i.e. most big creatures, which is why it's in that section, it can come up. So that's why the rule is there.
Way to go.
So the answer is... Maybe. All the time, there's no cover between adjacent foes.
Yes.
Or maybe some of the times if the creature's big. Just summarize real quick.
Whatever's most beneficial for the attacker.
For large-sized creatures, yeah.
Yes, for a large-sized or a larger attacker.
Right.
Yes.
So if it was their ally, then they could. But if it was an enemy that they would be possibly providing cover, then they wouldn't.
Yeah, whatever's more beneficial to them. They can choose square it's going to apply to.
Yeah.
Got it.
Beautiful.
Cool. Well, why don't you hit us up with the next one?
Oh, yeah, sorry, that was my fault. Cyril has a Galaxy of Intrigue question. And before we get into that, we do have plans to have the big RT and the big GA on an upcoming episode to delve into Galaxy of Intrigue. That would be Gary Asfolder and Rodney Thompson. But until then, we'll answer this as best as we possibly can. So, Cyril's question is this. The recurring success feat states, that you can select a talent or feat that can only be used once per encounter. You can now use it twice. Nice.
Mm-hmm.
How do you guys think this is meant to interact with the Tier 3 talents for the classes that grant you three abilities once per encounter? Do you think you should be able to use all three of them once more per encounter, or just one of the three? I could see it either way, but I wanted to get y'all's opinion on it.
Woohoo! He said y'all.
Y'all.
He did say y'all.
That's not how you spell it, though.
Yeah.
Just saying.
Well, Cyril is referring to this awesome recurring success feat found on page 28 of the newly released Galaxy of Intrigue, which, as he said, lets you once in a, use a once per encounter talent or feat twice per encounter. Wahoo! But we've had these amazing third-tier talents, as Rodney has referred to them as, in the last few books, such as the Noble's Beloved talent and the Two-Faced talent found in Scum and Villainy, the Soldier's Tactical Savvy talent, and the Scoundrel's Sly Combatant talent from Galaxy at War, as well as many, many others. Okay. Now, per the wording of recurring success, Cyril, well, first of all, do you guys understand the concept of those tier three talents I'm talking about? How have you seen what I'm talking about? They give you like three special things you can do once an encounter.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yep.
Okay. Okay. And the thing is, all those things, they're really cool, but a lot of them are very situational. So, you know, there is that. So honestly, Cyril, the feat says you can, you know, that you can use these once per encounter talents twice. Each of these multi-use talents are still only once per encounter talents, and I would rule that you could thus use all three abilities of it an additional time per encounter. Considering the dedication it takes to get to those tier three talents, I mean, you got to be, you know, seriously, I mean, you're looking at, you know, several levels, you know, in a single class without prestige classing. And considering how situational each one of those little bitty subsets of the talent is, I don't think that's too broken, frankly.
Yeah.
How would you guys interpret it?
Agree.
Yeah, I totally agree. I don't think there's... Yeah, I don't know if I'd give it a second thought. I think it'd be just fine.
Yeah.
Cool.
But I'm a player and I'm a Munchkin player, so I'd really go that route anyways. Yeah.
All right. So to wrap it up, Madul has a moving question with some potentially thorny answers. All right, so he's got a he like shotgunned us here, rapid fire, boom, 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 boom. So here we go. All right, so I'm confused. I am one confused bantha herder. There are several ways that you can reduce someone's movement. Typically, the reduction of movement will limit the character that is affected in such a way that they can only move a set number of squares as part of their normal movement. As an example, the cryo grenade. But here's the rub for me. What about abilities, force powers, and talents that, in effect, give you free movement? Do movement penalties stack with each other? How about free movements from another source? How about forced movements? What about jumps? How do they affect movement if you're impaired in such a way? What about destiny point surges with aforementioned jumpiness? My head hurts.
Yeah, that's a lot of questions. They all center around kind of one key thing, though, so I think it's worthwhile to Madul to break it down, okay? So there are dozens of ways through equipment, talents, feats, that you can limit a foe's movement, okay? The short answer is that you need to specifically note how that ability limits movement. Most of these abilities and items will simply reduce a foe's base speed by a set number of squares, saying their base speed is reduced by two squares or one square, whatever. Anything that affects their base speed will affect their base speed. So if they're granted a move action by the high-level noble, or they've got a cool feat that lets them move their base speed for free, then they do just that. They move their adjusted base speed. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So as for movement penalty stacking, let's say you throw a cryobang grenade at somebody and then use hobbling strike. Okay. Well, in general, like bonuses do not stack, but that's not so much the case for penalties. If a foe shoots out your hamstring, lopping off two squares of base speed, and then for one square of base speed, and then freezes you, lopping off another two squares. That's three squares total of reduced speed, period. Okay. Now, in terms of your questions regarding force powers, surge, all surge does is add additional squares to your base speed. So if you roll super high, you get the six square addition. That'll get added to whatever your modified base speed is. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go.
Great.
Jumpiness is very difficult. We talked about this briefly before, but there's different interpretations on it. My interpretation of the rules in sticking with D20 system specifics, because they don't go into it too terribly much, is that I believe that you can pretty much only jump your given movement speed. So if I wanted to, if I was somehow able to jump 12 squares, I could spend two move actions to do that. Okay. If I surge and destiny point it, and all of a sudden I can do a long jump of like 30 squares, okay, or I get a movement speed of 24 squares, then I could spend two move actions to do a long jump of, you know, 48 or whatever. But that's kind of how I run it. It would still affect things the same way it affects your base movement speed. So there you go.
Yeah.
Cool.
All right. So
thank you for the questions, guys.
Yes, that's what I was about to say. Good job.
Keep them coming. We likes the questions.
Yep.
Every day when I go to the d20radio.com/forum page and I go to the Order 66 board and I see the D20 docking bay little thread for questions, and I see the little light that tells me there's new posts, it makes my heart warm. It warms me in the cockles of my heart.
Oh my God.
Dave, what are we going to do with him?
We're going to move on.
Good idea.
Hey, welcome to Watto's. This is Watto for Watto's Bargain Basement. And I want you to come on down to Tatooine this week for our big special sale. Tell them Jabba sent you and you get a free chance cube. We got the deals for you. Come on down to Watto's Bargain Basement. What do you know?
Yep.
Okay, I may be dating myself here, but did you ever watch Get Smart when you were a kid?
Yes, I loved Get Smart.
See, well, you probably caught it on Nick at Night, didn't you, TG?
Uh-huh. Okay. So?
Okay, do you remember the Cone of Silence?
No, I really only remember his shoe and the
telephone. Dave, do you remember the Cone of Silence?
Not really.
Okay, well, then hopefully somebody listening out there will remember the Cone of Silence, which tried ineffectually to do what this piece of fine equipment actually does. So I got back from Watto's this week, Dave, with a VidVox Scrambler. Now, tech audio-visual geek that you are, have you heard of this thing?
Of course.
Oh, dude. I'm like, I don't know why I bought it, because I'm not really that paranoid. This is really for very, very paranoid people. But I don't know. It's handy to have. It was expensive. But, you know, Watto cut me a deal. Something about future child support. I'm not sure.
Nice.
So, basically, this device, the VidVox Scrambler, is for the ultimate just paranoid freak. What it does is it emits a low-frequency wave that scrambles all video, audio, and holo recording within its area of effect. When switched on, the device affects the square it's in and all squares adjacent to it. Okay, and basically anyone electronically eavesdropping or reviewing recordings of targets in this area must make a DC 30 perception or use computer check to pick up anything. And even then, all they pick up are scattered words and bits of data. That's it.
Really?
Yeah.
But it's only the square you're in. So it's
and adjacent squares.
Yeah. So if somebody's standing next to you.
Uh-huh.
But who's going to be standing next to you that you're not going to know is trying to eavesdrop and you just stop and walk away?
Well, I think more along the lines of cameras and doors when you're trying to get in and things like
Precisely. But like video cameras, hidden listening equipment, somebody tapping into a comm signal or something like that.
In other words, it's useless.
Dude, no. I totally see this. If you want to have, seriously, if you have people tapping into your stuff all the time, for all you hardcore GMs out there whose players are total punks and are super slicers and techs and like, they're, oh, wow, we're going to bust into Jabba's palace and, ooh, I'm going to slice into the comm terminal real quick and find out what Jabba's secret plan is and listen in on his closed circuit video cameras and whatnot or plant a bug in his room. This is the device that said crime lord would use to pee in your Cheerios, basically.
Yep.
After your hard work. So awesome. It's, like I said, very situational, but wonderful for the paranoid character. Now, it can operate continuously for 1 week on a power cell, or it can be hooked into a permanent power supply. And at 3,400 credits, it ain't cheap.
I get you a noble with wealth talent.
This is true. If you do, yeah. And if they're paranoid enough, it's worth its weight. So you can find the VidVox Scrambler on page 67 of the recently released Galaxy of Intrigue and for just a few creds and a little bit of paranoia. This cone of silence can be yours.
All right, hey, we got something we hadn't had in a while.
Woohoo!
Oh, that's just swell.
That's great! Hey, that's awesome!
When good games go great.
It's been a while since we've had that drop.
It's been a while. Dude, okay, have you read this yet?
Do you know that I did all the voices for that drop?
All of them?
Yep.
Even the tiny little high voice?
Yep.
Look at you. I had no idea you had that kind of octave range.
I don't.
Notice.
It's called Audacity.
Ah, yes. Okay, dude, have you read this When Good Games Grow Great segment yet?
I started to, but then my eyes actually exploded.
Oh, too much red?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, it's really long.
Well, it is very long, but it's a great story.
Shoot.
Absolutely fantastic. Okay, so the map maker's epiphany. We got an email from master map maker Chris West last week, and he shared with us a gaming moment that we couldn't not share. Every time we do When Good Games Were Great, you guys always give us feedback saying, we love it! We want more! We love hearing these gaming stories! So, here you go.
Double negative.
Chris West writes, so I had a great experience in my Saga Edition game last week, and I wanted to share it with you. I tried a couple new GMing tricks that seemed to pay off really well for the fun of my players and the enhancement of our campaign. First, a bit of backstory. My players are running a group of Jedi and their close allies through an adventure immediately following the events of Episode 3. Now, since Order 66 came down, the PCs have been on the run. They have a big transport ship and have recently acquired a massive amount of assorted cargo that they're trying to unload on Tatooine. Now, the players are a great group of people, but most of them have a certain tendency towards, quote-unquote, munchkinism. TG. They're very good at building diehard characters that are very difficult to challenge, so I'm forced to keep raising the bar. Well, this week I hit him with a back-to-back encounters without any time to rest in between, and the players are used to a certain amount of downtime between fights, so they don't hold anything back when it comes to the use of force powers and other renewable resources. So, at the end of the last session, some of the PCs finished up negotiations with a contact and in Mos Eisley and meant to return to their ship parked at this remote outpost across the Jundaland Wastes using a speeder truck they'd rented to get around while the techies in the party stayed in the Jundaland Wastes and repaired the ship. So I decided to hand wave away the uneventful trip I had mentioned at the end of their last session and interjected a big ambush encounter on the way back. First, I decided that a local gang has been engaging in piracy on various ground-based routes between local cities and outposts. Now, while the PCs were busy negotiating with their contact in the last session, these criminals sabotaged the Jedi's rented speeder truck with explosive charges designed to disable it during a specific point of the return journey, at which point the pirates planned to kill the occupants and take the valuable cargo. So the charges went off, and the stranded PCs, who are two Jedi and one NPC force-sensitive kid traveling with them, are in the Wastes overnight. They assess the situation, and they contact the other two PCs on board their still damaged ship and say, hey, bring us some repair parts. So, to complicate matters further, I decided that no visit to Tatooine would be complete without an encounter from the natives. So I set up a Tusken Raider encounter to occur before the pirates got there. The battle map was drawn up on gaming paper, and he takes the moment to pimp www.gamingpaper.com, which, by the way, we pimped after Gen Con. Very cool stuff. So the battle map's drawn up with a tall cliff rising up on one side of the trail, and then a deep canyon containing tall rock formations on the other side. I drew some boulders and smaller rocks on the map along the ridge, but I did not draw the PC's speeder truck or their cargo on their map. Instead, I designed some custom terrain tiles of cargo pieces and the speeder truck to lie on top of the map. Now this, as it turns out, really enhanced the game, as you'll see. The Sand People had two Banthas with them, and they attacked from either side of the trail. Excuse me. They attacked from either side of the trail. The speeder truck was still hovering in the middle of the road, as its repulsor lift was still functional. It had no propulsion. The Jedi had removed the cargo crates from the speeder truck to lighten the load as they worked underneath it, so those presented additional terrain features to provide cover. One of the crates, by the way, contained a live Nexu. Now, as the ambush unfolded, the Tuskens saw this opportunity to really ruin the PC's night. I didn't plan this from the beginning, but once I saw the opportunity on the map, I had to take it. They directed their Banthas to ram the speeder truck, and they tried to push the hovering vehicle right over the edge of the cliff. In the middle of the fight, the players, including the two other PCs who arrived during the battle, had to deal with an ever-changing tactical situation as the cargo crates and their speeders got shifted around the battlefield by stampeding Banthas. With move object and good use of the force roll, one of the Jedi saved the truck just as it was halfway over the edge and about to fall. Eventually, the PCs drove off the surviving Sand People, but then they saw the running lights from several other speeders arriving on the scene. They had one round of actions to prepare for another assault because the pirates had arrived. In the end, the PCs managed to fight off all their attackers, but the battle was intense. The pirates brought a skiff with an E-Web cannon mounted to it, a civilian speeder, and three speeder bikes, all represented by terrain tiles or miniatures loaded with enemies. Of these, only the skiff remained intact after the battle. The PC reinforcements brought their own bark speeder and a towed cargo sled, also represented by miniatures. Every object on the battle mat was moved or affected by the combat encounter, and the crate containing the angry Nexu was actually crushed open, adding another unexpected combatant to the fight. At one point, a speeder bike crashed right into the rented speeder truck, causing even more damage. When the dust settled, the Jawa Jedi was out of hit points and on the verge of death. Another Jedi was in single-digit hit points. A third was about half his hit points. The assassin droid was almost disabled for the third time in this campaign, and the NPC kid had lost one of his arms. But the players had experienced one of the most dynamic and exciting battles we've ever played out in our games, and now we have a whole new layer of intrigue to unravel as they try to figure out who organized this ambush and why. Awesome gaming moment, Chris.
Cool.
Totally awesome. So Chris like then went on to detail what made this encounter so dynamic. And good lessons to learn from all this. So listening to this story, I mean, I think there's some great things that we and the Gamer Nation as a whole can learn from this experience in terms of fun ways to build and structure an encounter. A couple key points. TG, does anything come to mind for you?
Well, he's got movable objects on the map.
And yeah, I mean, that's a big deal. I think he actually put it. It said in the email himself that, you know, if you place an object on the map in a way that allows it to be easily moved during the fight, it will be moved or blasted or crashed into or thrown at somebody or used for cover or all of the above. Had he just like drawn the spear on the map, it that would not have been nearly as memorable, and it would have just sat there. And I think you guys have experienced that. Yes.
Yeah.
I know the fight we had with the crate dragon. I had the speeder right there, and it was just a piece of terrain. You guys hid behind it. That was it. But because I drew it out on the map.
Right. Well, since then we've been using minis for a lot of our vehicles and such. Yeah. Now, I will say we haven't really used miniatures for crates and things. That would be kind of cool to be able to start throwing those things around.
See, somebody wasn't paying attention in our last session.
Well, that's what I was saying. We have not been. We just started. And those were pretty big.
Yeah. So, yeah. Well, I mean, what do you think about the way he handled the challenging of his PCs with back-to-back encounter?
No, it's fine.
It brings the unexpected. It allows the players, the PCs, to make sure they're staying on their toes. That's probably what made it more memorable, because they probably came expecting, okay, we're going to figure out we need to do something, then we're going to go fight, then we're going to go recover, and then we'll probably have another fight, then we'll go recover, and that'll be the end of the session. And it didn't go that way at all.
Uh-uh. See, nasty little trick that I used to partake of was to give them a little encounter and then let them solve for that encounter, but then when You know, if they take too much time making up their minds of what they're going to do or whatever, reinforcements arrive. Ah, yes.
Brev is a fan of that.
Mm-hmm.
So, very, very nice. But if you guys have, I mean, this is a great, great way to relate the just a simple concept. If you guys have Munchkin PCs that are mopping the floor with stuff, most Munchkinization, as long as they can have a good rest before the next encounter, they're ultimately super badasses again. But if you throw another encounter right at them, it's not going to go so well. My other favorite is not so much separate encounters, but what I call the fake BBEG. You present somebody that they think is going to be the big bad evil guy, the end boss, basically. You let them blow their wad fighting him, and then you bring out the real boss. That's always fun. So
yeah, as long as you play it off right, it's important that the GM does it right, or else he's just going to... And you've got to have the right group of people. I think that's always an important part of any good gaming session.
Yeah.
Because the wrong group of people are going to get pissed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well.
About that. So.
Absolutely.
And if they do, then they shouldn't be game with you anyway. So.
Yeah. Right.
All right. Let's stop down for Fragments from the Rim. What do you say?
Let's do it. Thanks, Chris.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Chris, by the way.
Welcome, Jedi Masters, to Fragments from the Rim. How may we be of service to you today?
Hi, this is Alex.
And Trevor.
This is segment number 42 of Fragments from the Rim. For this segment, I've chosen to talk about getting your opponent flat-footed. There are some very nice feats and talents in other places that come into play when your opponent is flat-footed. But unlike other variations of the D20 system, it's not all that easy to get someone flat-footed. In fact, in D&D 3.5, it was really easy. All you had to do was flank someone. Well, there's a talent, or two, in Galaxy at War that makes this a little easier. One of them brings back that old mechanic from D&D 3.5. That is a scoundrel talent entitled Backstabber, which you will find on page 20 of Galaxy at War. It has a prerequisite of sneak attack, which is rather useful because you want to use the sneak attack ability anyways. It says, you can take advantage of your adversary's distractions no matter how momentary or fleeting. Once per turn, when you flank a target, you can treat him or her as flat-footed for one of your attacks. Now, that is only one of your attacks, so it doesn't really help if you've got a multi-attacking character. But it is once per turn, not just once per encounter. You don't have to make a feint. You don't have to make any kind of dice roll. You do need to get into a flanking position, but that can be arranged. That's a pretty nice talent. There's also another talent on the same page. This is a scout talent. It's in the camouflage talent tree. It's entitled Ghost Assailant. If you start your turn with total concealment or total cover from a target, during that turn you can make a stealth check as a swift action opposed by the target's perception check. If you succeed, the target is considered flat-footed against you until the end of your turn. Again, another way to get those talents and abilities that are connected to flat-footedness into action. Both of them quite useful. Over to you, Trevor.
Today, I'm going to talk about the Noble Talent from the Master of Intrigue talent tree on page 20 of the Galaxy of Intrigue. The talent in question is Get Into Position. Once per encounter, at the start of your first turn, choose two allies within 12 squares and in your line of sight. Each ally can move immediately up to his speed as a reaction. That is really cool because, again, it's showing how the noble is a coordinator, a helper, a strategist, somebody who makes people get into the right position at the right time. So at the very first turn in the round, you move two of your people. Now, if you're high enough in the initiative and you go before other people in your party, you can move people like their distance so that the melee guys can get closer, the range guys can back up, people can get into cover, whatever the situation demands. If you're low enough in the order, you can finish that move that somebody needs to get into the position that they failed to get into last time, or you can reposition people for better effectiveness because of the response of the bad guys who have now moved. So it goes back to the idea that what I really like about Star Wars as opposed to D&D in the 3.5 version, D&D 3.5, the whole thing was getting up to, you know, the bad guy and standing there and just beating at him until one of you fell. In Star Wars, it's always about movement and positioning and planning and strategy. It's a lot more of an interactive concept when it comes to moving, as opposed to just getting up there and standing there and hitting each other with a beat stick. So I think this is a really cool talent. Anyways, if you have any questions or comments, please send Alex or I an email at order66_fragments@rogers.com. And until next time, have fun gaming.
Thank you, Masters, for visiting Fragments from the Rim.
How I may be of service to... Oh, never mind, sorry. yes. Ah, see, you were going with the... overlord look there. I was going for the Jawa, since my hoodie is red. I was going for the Jawa look there, Unabomber-esque.
Jawas have red... I thought it was brown hoodies.
They look red to me. That's okay. Fine. Though. Whatever. Oh! Wait a second.
Oh!
Ah, yes, the meat of the show. Hey, there's a Misty Lynn in the chat room. I don't remember seeing that name.
Misty Lynn.
That sounds like a girl.
I would hope so, with a name like Misty Lynn.
So, yep, as such, I need to know how old you are and if you're hot. Okay, go ahead and put that in there right now. Thank you.
Awful. Welcome to the meat of the show, Gamer Nation. So, okay, we were inspired... I was inspired by Chris West's earlier related game story. And we felt it was high time on this show to help you consider how best to handle the concepts of terrain and cover in your encounters and sessions. Now, as a key component of the list, proper terrain can mean the difference between a boring encounter and a memorable one. And as Chris West's story illustrates, we're going to get in depth with a brief refresher on the terrain, cover, and concealment rules, and how best to weave them into an encounter. And then we're going to talk about the best ways to represent that cover on the game table itself. So get ready, get your back to the wall, behind a crate, take aim, avoid pot shots, as we prepare to cover the cover.
yeah.
Ah. What if so
you're,
clever.
But what if you're a large creature? I mean, you know, with
need large cover.
okay. All right. No problem.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So when you say next door, do you mean tchotchkes or flingers? Chilies or flingers?
Yeah.
Flingers?
Yeah, chilies or flingers?
Flingers.
Flingers. Yeah,
definitely. Okay. Oh, okay. All right. Yes, the way of the cargo crate. I'm sorry. What?
Excuse me. I believe you don't have the required number of pieces of flair on.
Yeah.
I have 27 pieces of flair.
I totally lost. I have no idea what you were talking about.
Office space, girl.
Yes, I know, but aren't we supposed to be talking about terrain and cargo and
Okay. Yeah. Fair enough. So, the introduction to this discussion as we're coming up with things, basically, I like to call this the way of the cargo crate. So, as discussed way back in episode 37, The List, cover and concealment, an essential part of any good encounter. One of the worst things you can ever do to your players, and for Pete's sake, your NPCs, is to place them all in just a blank room and have them fight it out. So we're going to be talking about cover. So how does cover work? Before we talk about integrating into the encounter, I think it's worthwhile to go over just a very brief synopsis of the cover rules, which are, you know, the basics are simple and covered on page 157 and 158 of the core rulebook. TG, what is cover? When do you have cover?
Well, you have cover when one character you can draw a line between one character and another from the two corners of the two character squares. And if that line passes through an obstacle or another character, creature, or droid, then they have cover from each other.
Well,
pretty
okay,
simple.
Well, what if two corners of the two character squares don't hit obstacles, but two different corners do when you draw the line? Do they still have cover?
I think it's cover within line of sight.
Right.
Any two corners.
Any two corner squares. So I can choose, if I can draw a line from any corner of somebody's square to any corner of someone else's square, any combination, and that line at all hits any type of obstacle, then they have cover.
Right. And if they have cover, then an attacker provides the defender. Well, not the attacker provides it. The defender has a plus +5 cover bonus against the attacker to their reflex defense.
Got it.
Yes.
Now, okay, so if that imaginary line goes through what? Like walls or boxes or plants or
other characters.
That's right.
Other characters do count.
There's a term for that, isn't there?
Called soft cover.
Soft cover. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. This is often a huge encounter mistake. People forget about soft cover. Yep. But now, okay. Now, if I have somebody between me and the target, I'm gonna get a +5 to my reflex defense. What if I have like 4 people between me and the target? Do I get a +20 to my reflex defense?
Negative.
No.
You run on normal.
Okay.
Nope.
Okay. So it doesn't stack. Oh, okay. Okay. That's good to know. Okay, well, okay, so Dave, if that's what cover is, what's improved cover? Because I've heard that term tossed around too.
All right, so think of this. Think of you are, well, first, it's kind of the same as cover, but when it is really large, okay, it occurs when an obstacle is really, really large or so large that you need to represent that it's improved cover. So let's say a character that has his weapon through a gun slit.
Okay.
Or the Israelis' weapon of choice now, a gun that shoots around corners. So you would have improved cover. So you would get +10 to your reflex defense.
Okay, so like you can only see a little bitty bit of that person.
Right. I mean, little bitty. I mean, it'd be a tough shot, like Destiny Point hard.
Gotcha. Fair enough. Okay. Now, as you guys will recall, there are two methods to get around cover. The first one is the easiest, and that's simply to move. move to a point where there is no longer cover between you and the target. That's probably the easiest way to do it. The second, almost as easy way, is to aim. Page 154 of the Core Rulebook. Spend 2 swift actions to pause, aim, line up your shot, and ignore all bonuses that cover grants to that particular target. Soft cover,
now,
everything.
So now, but we're not really going to talk about the aiming part of dealing with cover.
No.
We're going to talk about the movement part of either getting around cover to get at your enemies or to get protection, right?
Well, we're
focused on.
We're focusing on a GM getting cover integrated into their encounter properly. It's just good to let, you know, before you go into that, you need to remember these rules, guys, because when you're designing your map and when you're designing the encounter, you need to think about from where the party's going to be at and in what ways they're going to most likely choose to overcome that cover. So it can make a real difference in terms of where you place it, so on and so forth.
You're so biased towards GMs. What about the players?
Ba-bam! Well, yes. If GMs do what we talk about here, hopefully their players will be having a lot more fun in that encounter. So, okay, so that's the basics of cover. We're done. Let's get to the nitty-gritty. Let's talk about, guys, creating cover in your encounter. And correct me if I'm wrong here, but I don't think there should ever with an A be an encounter that you design where there is no cover options available.
What if it's a skill challenge encounter?
Well, it's not a combat encounter. If it's a combat encounter.
See, you didn't say that though.
Yes. Yeah, well, to be fair, you don't. You know, we've only had the official skill challenge rules for about 2 weeks. So,
cop out.
It's cop out. It's okay. So, obviously, we're talking about setting up combat encounters.
Obviously.
Yes. So, I mean, my questions, I guess, were, you know, what are some good examples and thoughts that you can always refer to, depending on the scene? I think there are several types of cover that we can sort of group cover into that should always cross your mind, okay? Some are obvious and others less so. Dave, what's the first type of cover that's the most common one that's usually going to cross people's mind when they think of cover?
Well, that's going to be, you know, your columns, fountains, whatever, stable cover. It's really readily accessible, cannot be moved, very difficult to destroy, because usually it's part of the architecture or part of the terrain itself. So we're talking about columns that go from the ceiling to all the way down to the floor. Okay. Talking about low walls, corners, big-ass fountains.
I like big-ass fountains.
Yeah, exactly. Especially when the big-ass fountain has, like, large planters and statues on them. Those are also available, yeah. Or when you're outside, trees and funky, rocky outcroppings.
As anyone who's game with me know, I'm a huge fan of funky-looking, rocky outcroppings.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice. Okay, so that's stable cover. That's the type of cover that is what we all usually think of when we think of making sure there's cover in an encounter. But TG, what's a step up from that that I think a lot of GMs should get more comfortable putting in?
Well, that would be very similar to what Christopher West put in his, and that's things that can be moved around. Movable cover. It provides more than just a key component to your list, to mm-hmm. the list, but it can actually add a slew of tactical options for the players and for the NPCs.
Mm-hmm.
That cover that can move with you or be moved either by the force or on its own is probably some of the best kinds of cover out there. You've got tables. You can kick over a table for cover.
That's so cinematic.
Yeah, it really is.
Okay, okay, TG, you've not GM'd, but this question came up, so I want your opinion on it, okay? If there's a freestanding table and a player wants to just kick it over for cover, I mean, I want to just kick it over and get down behind it for cover.
That's okay. To kick it would be a swift action, but to crouch behind it, I would probably either be a move action or maybe another swift action, but just kicking a table over?
Okay. Well, even if they kick it over, it's still waist height, so they'll get some cover from it. Okay. I feel you. I agree with the swift act. Okay, anyway, I wanted to ask you that. So.
All right. But, you've got the typical cargo crates, speeders, load lifters. You see them everywhere in movies
movable options.
And stuff. Yeah, they're movable. You can pick up cargo crates. You can open them and toss pieces of them around or whatever, There's
okay,
things
well, okay,
to do with it.
Well, now wait a second. What if I'm outside? There's not a lot outside that I can just move around, though.
Ewoks.
Dead bodies.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Fair enough.
Nope. Boulders, fallen logs,
gazebos.
I mean, when the Battle of Endor, right? All the Ewoks.
Fair enough,
logs everywhere that they're hiding behind and stuff. Yeah.
I couldn't see a Jedi like ripping a hunk of mountain out of the ground and throwing it, but definitely like a freestanding rock or a boulder.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's fair enough. That's fair enough.
Now, is there another type of cover that we're not thinking about, that Dave and I aren't thinking about?
Well, you may be, but there's one that I think is underutilized, and the person I've seen it use it to the best extent actually is actually GM Cat. In her game, she uses this a lot, and that would be destroyable cover. I think destroyable cover is a nasty surprise for your PCs. It's cover that only lasts a round or two. That flimsy table you kicked over might only take a single blaster shot if your foe targets it instead of you, and that blaster shot just will probably disintegrate it entirely. So as a reminder, guys, pages 152 and 153 of the core rulebook covers hit points and DR for common objects and substances. But ideally, if you're going to place destroyable cover, it should go down in one or two shots, okay?
If you're in that situation and your player says, I'm going to kick over this table for cover, and you're a GM, and you're like, you know what? My little baddie right here is going to shoot the table instead of the player. Are you really going to stop and open up the core rulebook and look it up, or just make a call as to what sounds right?
I think it's going to depend on the style of the GM. I know what I would do, but my thing is this. If a player comes at me and says, man, I'm going to kick over the cover for table, and boom, and he pulls out his gun, he gets there, I will probably not destroy the table, even if it's flimsy, because that's so cool. But I think this tactic is terribly effective for players who wish to monkey with the cover being used by NPCs.
Yes, that's very true.
Okay, so in that instance, if you're wrecking my carefully planned encounter by saying, I'm going to attack the table because it looks flimsy, as a GM, you may want to be able to turn and find out how long that's going to take. So, okay, another thing, too, is oftentimes, maybe if a fight is going poorly, you can use destroyable cover to shift the odds in the PC's favor as a GM without making it seem like you're handing them something. If they just can't hit these guys who are hiding behind what is destructible cover and the PCs aren't thinking to attack the cover, you are then your rights as GM to call for a knowledge physical sciences or a knowledge tactics check as a reaction. And if they make, like, set an easy DC, say, you know, you notice that that table he's behind is pretty flimsy. And that usually will give him a good hint. So, flimsy crates, tables, chairs, glass barricades.
She's the Finsta.
Shrubberties. Yeah, dude. The great scene from Die Hard. He had cover, you know, they blew it up. That's pretty much it. And the last piece of destroyable cover, which you seriously need to be think about and consider, but be careful with it, is cover that goes kaboom. Destroyable cover that, when destroyed, just might have some violent results. Fuel canisters, power conduits, crates of hazardous materials, okay? I think it's hilarious. If the stormtrooper doesn't realize that he's just taking cover behind a fuel canister and you shoot it, that's funny.
Yeah.
That's absolutely hilarious. So for such, like, destroyed dangerous cover, you know, when it's destroyed, it could simply deal damage, like maybe an explosion, or maybe it could leak some corrosive chemical and start a chemical fire, or maybe it's holding in waste and all of a sudden you're dealing with a radiation hazard in the encounter. Really nasty.
Now, I'm going to throw something at you here. We're talking about stuff on the ground if we're battling. So what about cover in the air, either when you're on a speeder bike or even if you're doing ship combat?
See, now that's something I didn't think about, but I should have, because I know we've had some good examples in our games, TG. Yeah. I mean, do you recall the one shot for Gen Con, The Secret of the Corellian Kitehawk, that I wrote up?
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that, because there was an air speeder encounter in that.
Yeah, well, I thought it was really cool because you had, it was not only just cover, but it was obstacles, first of all, that we had to go around, which were, I guess, big steam pipes coming from factories up in the sky. And then clouds of steam came out of the top of those, and those actually provided cover for us. Now, I don't know if it was soft cover or what it was.
It was concealment.
Concealment, okay, which is
Not quite cover.
Okay.
You can shoot straight through it, but yeah. Yeah, you can fly through, you can move through concealment, you can't move through cover.
Now, we've also had cover in space battles because we've had like asteroids moving around. And that's also a fun skill challenge for someone who's piloting at the same time providing cover.
Yes, yes. I think it's you know, when in space, it can often be difficult to provide different cover options. But I do think destroyable cover is very common in space, especially if you have hunks of ship flying around. And
It's leaking.
Yeah. I know you guys have had a couple space battles where you shot some, you know, derelict ship in front of you that was providing cover, and it exploded rather violently.
So, yeah, I remember that. That was cool.
Yeah, it was cool. I think we actually took one of our enemy ships out with it.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very cool.
Of course we did.
So, okay, we've talked about stable cover, we've talked about movable cover, we've talked about destroyable cover. There is a fourth type of cover that you should consider when planning it for your campaign. And Dave, elucidate us.
Elucidate again?
Yes, I'm a fan of the elucidation.
All right, of the soft cover?
Soft.
Of the soft cover, that's right. The meat shield, boys.
I like meat shields.
Ah, that's what she said.
Other
characters, droids, beasts can provide cover for you in a pinch. Of course, on the downside of that is that that cover will probably and will often move on its own and is also capable of being destroyed. So,
very nice.
Yeah. You know, what are you going to do?
Don't the nobles have a special feat where they can get a comrade that can follow them around and basically get a meat shield?
Talent, yeah.
Yeah.
And then they're just directing that person to stand in front of them who can be soft covered the whole time.
Stand in front of me.
Take the bullet. Take the bullet. Yeah. So Yeah, a lot of times you wind up using this because it's the only thing readily available to you.
Fair enough. Now, who would you use most often? I mean,
your Wookiees. Bad guy. Oh
no,
the bad guy. You would use yes. The bad guy, or if I was a bad guy, I would use a civilian and a child.
Civilians, bystanders.
That's very true. That's very true. Why is this option not used very often? Honestly, do you guys? I mean, I don't see players, especially with like civilians or bystanders or crowds of people. I don't see GMs and players in games actively using other people as cover.
Well, aside from the bar, the bar type encounter, or we've had these cantina encounters. Aside from those, I mean, when else do we really have any encounters have?
Well, yeah, but what I'm saying is, okay, listen, when I'm watching people play. Okay, the GM will describe the scene, and it's like a crowded cantina or a crowded nightclub, to use your examples. It's filled with hundreds of people. But when the combat encounter starts and the minis hit that map, there's like 10 minis on the map, and that's it.
Oh, well, yeah, because we don't use minis. We don't draw the people. You know, it's too much time.
Right. But
it's a lot to deal with. And at the same time, I think if there's probably, and this may be really off in left field, but when an NPC, like a little bystander, all of a sudden comes into play and starts being used by the GM, the players then think that NPC is somebody who's important.
Well,
often.
Yeah, but I mean, it's up to a play style, but it's like, you hit the nail on the head. People don't put bystanders in because it's a pain in the ass, okay? It's a pain in the ass to draw them usually, but to Chris West's example from when his story, when you put something physical on the map, it will usually get used. And I think about the dearth of tactical options that were not used in so many encounters because people forgot that there's, 20 NPCs milling about that they can use for cover. I don't know. I mean, seriously, is it that hard to keep a bag of like just random, normal looking minis and to have so you can just throw them out there for an encounter, and just have them go in like initiative zero, like at the end of the encounter, and have them move like two squares each. The GM just adjusts them really quick as they just like run around wildly or whatever. I don't know, man. That could be a lot of fun.
I think that makes a lot of sense. Or you can get little dots or whatever. Find.
Yeah, that.
You broke up bad, TG.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. It's
you didn't break. It was Skype, not your mic.
Oh. That's weird because I was hearing you break up really bad earlier.
Ah, okay.
Weird.
So.
That's Skype.
So, right, okay, so aside from people and other enemies, I feel like we're missing something in terms
droids.
Of
droids. Droids. They're everywhere. Yeah, it's freaking Star Wars.
Ubiquitous, are they?
They are. TG, you hit the nail on the head. Guys, if droids are not common in every scene you have, running about, delivering things, fixing things, then why the hell not? Unless you're like in a jungle somewhere or on the desert. All right? Droids, instant soft cover in a pinch, man. And like that heroic Jedi who would never grab an innocent bystander to use them as a meat shield. Do you think should he have any problem grabbing a protocol droid and holding it up in front of him to take the shots as he moves forward?
Yes, if he belongs to one of his other teammates.
Or if he's part of the Anti-Vandalism League.
Oh, yes. Very nice. Yes, if he's part of the yes. Because in essence, yes, the droid is now riddled with holes and you have committed vandalism on that droid.
Dun, dun, dun.
Okay, so ultimately, guys, we've talked about several types of cover in order to maybe show some options and some things to think about that you may not have thought about. But when you consider cover for your encounter, when you're going through the list and you're checking off that step and you're putting cover in the encounter, it is ideal to ensure that you have at least two of the above types of cover of the four types we just talked about readily available in the encounter. The more types you have, the better, but at least two of the above types will ensure that you have solid tactical options in the encounter. You're not going to railroad them through the encounter. You're going to give them the ability to accomplish it in multiple ways, and that's a really really important thing for any GM to make sure his encounter allows.
Yep.
So to wrap the discussion up, I really wanted to talk about showing cover in your encounter. So as Chris West's story illustrated, simply drawing your cover out on the battle mat, that can work, okay? But usually it doesn't go out of the way to encourage players to use the cover tactically in interesting ways, okay? Now, I think there's numerous ways to illustrate cover creatively on the map, and we'd love to give you guys some tips, some tricks, some ideas from the don't hardly cost you nothing to the, gee, I've really got some cash to blow options for having cover on the map. TG, what's the simplest way to make sure you have cover on the map? To display it?
Well, just to draw it, basically.
Yeah.
Unless you're doing an entire counter with 3D terrain, which might be possible for you, takes an awful lot of work, then stable architecture cover is usually just drawn directly on the map. And drawing it shows that it's stable.
I use paper mache.
I use foam molding.
The foam molding.
the foam molding. Right. Okay, speaking of paper mache and foam molding.
Styrofoam and Dremel.
Dude, right. Dave, what about like minis and 3D terrain?
Oh yeah, if you're using like the 3D terrain that's already set up, dude, I mean that's where you can really start to have fun with it, you know? After you've drawn out your counter map, right? Or you lay it out, you know, if say you're using a Christopher West map or something along those lines, you add these little 3D fiddly bits, like minis, for example. You've got to use them, put them in there for soft cover, dude, you know? What you talked about before, you know, grab a bag of you know, non-specific stuff and throw them around, you know, let them move around, and when the first gunshot goes off, have them all crouch behind tables, and it limits the cover options for the, you know, it's kind of fun. Anyway, yeah, so use miniatures.
Fair enough. What about, like, ships, like miniature ships? I mean, because obviously ships and speeders, like we talked about, provide a pretty fair amount of cover. There's actually a pretty good amount of character scale speeders and other vehicles, like, in the Star Wars minis line, yeah?
Oh, yeah, yeah, I forgot about that.
I mean, not a whole lot, but there's some there. And failing that, dude, I've seen Matchbox cars used at the table. I've seen Star Wars toys, the vehicles designed for the action figures, used at the table.
Yeah. Anything will work.
Yeah, dude. Wow. I'm all about it. Now, TG, you and Dave, you too have seen a lot of this stuff. I know, Dave, you got kind of introduced to a lot of it for the first time up at ReaperCon last year. TG, you've seen a lot. Talk to me about molded terrain, girl. Talk to me about full-on 3D terrain.
Yeah, like, you have to have some major talent, really, to do this. And some time, some major time and patience. Most of these are dedicated miniature grognards and old-school miniature warfare geeks. And I've got much to learn from them. I would love to be able to do this stuff. I honestly would, but I just... Oh my gosh, it takes so much. But it's so fun, and you can make it so custom. There's other options, though, for people who, like me.
Yeah, okay, what if I don't have the time, but I've got like an ass load of money?
Well, you can get the pre-molded and pre-painted stuff. It's extremely expensive, but if you've got the money, you can have walls, doors, crates, and ships, and all of it have the Star Wars look and feel to it. Just go to, you know, online. I think one of the most well-known ones is Dragonforge, and that's at dragonforge.com.
Dragonforge has some really good stuff.
Yeah, they've got some really cool stuff. They're at Gen Con every year.
They're at Gen Con every year. And they do a whole line of, like, Star Wars... Oh, no, excuse me. Science fiction role-playing themes.
Yes. Yes.
You know, stuff. And, you know, floors and terrain and all this other really cool stuff. I'm a huge fan of, actually, if you really want to do, like, some full 3D stuff and you don't want to fork over the hundreds and hundreds of dollars that the, like, Dragonforge stuff will cost you if you go all out... there's a bunch of do-it-yourself molds. In particular, a website called Hirst Arts, H-I-R-S-T-A-R-T-S, And Hearst Arts actually sells silicone molds that you pour plaster into, and you pop the pieces out. And they come out as pieces of terrain, and you can just glue, assemble them and paint them yourself. And, you know, the hard work's done. The painting is really what takes some time. I was – Brev and I both got a package several weeks ago from a fellow named Ray, who is Jawas Ate My Jedi, on the D20 Radio forums. And he does some Hearst Arts miniature molds, and he sent us some, like, rocky terrain and some crates.
You used that in our last game, actually.
Yeah, I did. I got to use it in our last game, and it was fantastic. It was fun because, you know, it made the cover immediate. It drew attention to it, and they were movable. It was – wonderfully useful.
Yeah, 3D stuff is really cool, but there's other types of 3D things that you can do.
Oh dear. Dave, have you ever, I don't know if you have, man, have you ever spent any time working papercraft?
I haven't. I've seen it, and we've had some listeners send us their work in some of this papercraft, and I mean, it's amazing what some of the templates that we've gotten that you can cut and fold these things up, and they turn into things that are simply incredible.
It's really cool.
Origami man.
Dude, practically. But I mean, listen, when all you can really afford is a printer, paper, and some time, maybe some glue. Now, I mean, it's a fun alternative. TG, I know you and I have done some fantasy paper crafting.
Yeah, we did. That was really cool. We made buildings and where you can take the top off, and now the building that's standing there, you can actually go inside of it, and it has different pieces of furniture and stuff. It makes it a lot of fun being able to do that. So
it's very cool. The only downside to papercraft is that it is fragile.
Yes, it is.
Which is very cool. But if you guys are looking for some 3D papercraft, where if you want to, you know, see what you can do, there's a lot of stuff on the inner tubes. There's two sites that I would recommend to start your journey at. Okay, the first one is www.swminiatures.com, where they've got sections devoted to both 3D and 2D paper tiles. Okay, where you can just, you know, print, cut, paste, and you're done. And then I would like to take the time to pimp out a smaller site run by D20 Radio alum Ghost of Man, whose homepage is www.ghostofman.com. And he's got a lot of awesome papercraft PDFs on his site that are sci-fi and fantasy themed. So very cool stuff. But then there's the easiest option of all, which is just going to be, I know I've done this for you guys quite a bit, and I'll do it for pickup mods too. 2D, just 2D bits of paper.
Yeah.
The websites we've mentioned, swminiatures.com, Ghost and Ghost of Man's website, and hundreds more. You can just, you know, type in, you know, Star Wars paper minis, Google it, and you will get dozens and dozens of sites that provide you with just this most basic and simple choice. A 2D printable tile that can be printed on cardstock for durability and simply moved about the battle mat, which is really what sounds like Chris West did.
And if you've got the wherewithal, or if you're going to be using it a lot, like if you're going to be running games at Gen Con or some other con, you laminate them. And then it allows you, if the specific item takes damage, you can actually just mark it on that item.
Yes.
And it's very helpful if you've got several of that specific, you know, lots of speeders out there. Well, then you can just mark on which speeder, how much damage it's taken. And then the game's over, you take it off, and next session it starts all over again, fresh and clean.
Beautiful.
I would love to say that I make minis and, you know, like Hearst Arts stuff all the time, and oh, I own a whole bunch of Dragon Forge, and oh man, I've got a papercraft collection that'll blow your mind. I don't have time. Okay. I just don't. I love it and I would like to use it, but I don't. In my games as a GM, I use the 2D option. And like TG says, find a great picture, throw some 1-inch grid lines on it if it's more than one square, and print it out on cardstock. Laminate it if you're going to use it again. It is so terribly useful, and it takes up almost no space. And, like, you guys, you know those little, like, hover platforms that I created for,
Yeah, that's what I thought of immediately.
Dude, yeah, and how many adventures have I used those for?
A lot.
A lot.
Yeah, quite a few.
Almost every single one now.
Yeah, I mean, they're great because they provide instant cover, and I can say, you know, this is a hover platform. This is a floating Senate platform in the Great Hall. This is a crate. This is a, you know, and just throw it out there, and it can be moved. It can, you know, all that. Yeah, seriously, it's fantastic. So, good work. Guys, if you want to find out more about some of these options to find these things, to find ways to display cover, you can head over. You will find a thread open right now and stickied in the Star Wars Saga Edition forum at d20radio.com/forum with all of the above links that we've talked about just now, as well as user-contributed links and other info. If you're listening to this and you'd like to pimp out a website that has some awesome printable tiles on it or some great paper craft or some other cool custom 3D terrain, throw it up in this thread, okay, because we can all benefit from that knowledge.
Peep that.
So very cool. Christopher West, thank you for kicking off that discussion. It got me excited.
Yeah, it did.
Indeed.
Is it time, Dave?
It is. It is.
I don't want to go. TJ's gonna put me back in the cage.
Yeah.
It's where you belong.
I know. Thank you all. Thank you to my co-host, GM Dave, and Twi'lek Goodness. And thank you to the Gamer Nation. And thank you also to the bottom of my hearts. I did a final count before the show, and I received a total of, I mean, Dave, I don't know about you, but just personally, I received a total of emails and PMs totaling 48 as of today, asking, you know, hey, is the podcast going to stick around? You know, don't go away.
Really? You got 48?
Yeah, total PMs and emails, yes.
Dude, I got 2.
What can I say, man?
I got 0.
It's all right.
Nobody loves
me. Yeah, well, dude, I'm bringing sexy back. Everybody wants a piece. What can I say?
Oh, Lord.
Why does Gamer Nation have to inflate his already inflated head?
Yeah. Baby, if it ever gets too big, you're always there to pop it with a giant pin of guilt and shame.
Yeah, that's all right.
That's what I do. It's my job as your wife.
It's my job. It's what I do. Thank you, Gamer Nation. And we will see you next week. This is GM Chris. Oh, no, we're not going to see you next week because it's Super Bowl Sunday.
Right. So we'll be off next week.
Oh, we'll be off next week. But we're going to try and engineer a midweek cast, aren't we?
It's possible. I think I'm going to have some business travel interfering with that, so we'll see.
Okay, but keep your eyes on the forum, Gamer Nation. We'll let you know. This is GM Chris wishing you peace, love, and good gaming.
Hi, this is Sendragon, and I listened to the Order 66 podcast once, but after I told my GM what I had done, he gave me 2 dark side points. So now, I never listen to the Order 66 podcast.
Oh, yeah, keep the dice rolling.
May they be full of the Force.
Hi, this is Rikoshi, and I never listen to the Order 66 podcast. At least, that'll be my alibi if the ISB comes around asking questions. Or if anyone tries to induct me in TG's paternity suit.
D20 Radio, where gamers roll.
www.d20radio.com. This podcast and related websites are not endorsed by Lucasfilm Limited, 20th Century Fox, or Wizards of the Coast, and are intended for entertainment and informational purposes only. The official Star Wars site can be found at starwars.com. The official Wizards of the Coast site can be found at wizards.com. Star Wars, the Star Wars logo, D20 logo, D20 system references, all named pictures of Star Wars characters, vehicles, and any other Star Wars related items are registered trademarks and or copyrights of Lucasfilm Limited, Wizards of the Coast, or their respective trademark and copyright holders. All original content of this podcast and its related website, including graphical, textual, audio, and visual information, is the intellectual property of the Order 66 podcast.